It's important from the firm's perspective that this is considered as firms make decisions within national and regional markets, and the impact that this may have on investment and trade patterns and the emergence of new financial markets within this context would be important to policymakers within SADC. As the SADC region moves towards greater regional integration, we believe firm-level decisions are critical in integrating the economic space of the region, which is currently fragmented by policy barriers and inconsistent incentives for firms to do business in the region, as well as high transaction costs of doing business. Chairperson, I want to turn to the issue of foreign direct investment. FDI plays an important role in Africa's growth. At the time of the 2000 SADC summit, the SADC region attracted only 1% of global FDI. With the implementation of the SADC protocol and the formation of a regional economy, it is the hope of organized business in South Africa that SADC will continue to emerge as a more attractive investment destination for attracting FDI. Strengthening SADC financial and investment integration can become the basis for strengthening continental-wide integration with regards to finance and investment, which will signal changing patterns for finance flows for Africa in the 21st century. Foreign direct investment may also be an important stimulus to innovation. The cost of producing and exporting new goods, as well as adopting new technologies, may be lowered through FDI, since foreign agents are likely to be more familiar with these techniques in their country of origin. The role of intra-firm transactions and joint projects between these companies resident in SADC and those from abroad, and the involvement of participating governments is an important mechanism for technology transfer and knowledge sharing, which can contribute to the expansion of value-added production in the region. Turning to trade and investment promotion, in general, investment promotion policies are informed by the guaranteed provision of efficient infrastructure, business-friendly tax regimes, favorable labor market conditions, and affordable business costs, particularly regarding business inputs, to name but a few. It's generally been in the interest of developing countries to adopt domestic policies that encourage foreign direct investment that become a stimulus for improving trade and investment. A number of countries within SADC and a number of sub-regions, such as the provinces of South Africa, have established active trade and investment promotion agencies. The work of these agencies must continue to promote not only the incentives and favorable conditions for investment flows into SADC from abroad, it must also promote intra-SADC investment within the SADC region among SADC countries, making the SADC region a more attractive investment destination for conducting cross-border trade and economic activities within the region. The SADC trade protocol, which is already in effect, should therefore be assisted by the harmonization of finance and investment policies, as envisaged by the protocol before us today, by making it more convenient and attractive for firms to make justifiable investment in finance decisions across national boundaries within the region. Chairperson, in turning to the issue of SMMEs, small micro and medium enterprise development, we as business believe it's fundamental that the finance protocol for SADC takes into account and lends itself to advancing the development and support for SMMEs, not just within the region, but across the continent. Successful economic regions such as those in Far East Asia have demonstrated the importance of a strong small business sector as the backbone for more expansive regional economic development. In many of these instances, an enabling regulatory environment and access to financial markets have been the path breaker for achieving longer term success. Firms within the SADC region have to operate increasingly within a globalized economy that presents opportunities for increasing market access. But often it's more difficult for small firms in the region to enter these markets and to benefit from the opportunity presented. Increased economic cooperation, as envisaged through the SADC finance protocol and building on the SADC trade protocol, provides a way of addressing the issue by enabling small firms of SADC countries, both in size and their financial power, to overcome the obstacles. The role of networking and partnering relationships is emerging as an instrumental tool in fostering knowledge diffusion and innovation among small firms in the region. There therefore exists a unique relationship between the role of networking, foreign direct investment, and joint ventures amongst small enterprises. There is significant potential, we believe, for firms, particularly small firms, to learn and expand the technological capability through extensive active networks of foreign technology suppliers and foreign partners. Technological innovation spans diverse areas, including skills and adaptability of the workplace, the efficiency with which resources are used, and the rapid adaptation to new techniques. Investment in education and training to improve labor's efficiency in the production process is therefore as important as investment in fixed capital, plant, and machinery. Whether local firms, especially small enterprises, can harness these learning opportunities offered by foreign connections is largely dependent on the timing, dynamics, and sequencing of policy development embodied in domestic policies and regional agreements in place, such as the SADC trade and the SADC finance and investment protocol. Chairperson, the last issue that organized business would like to talk to is that of development finance. Africa is currently experiencing major financial transitions that require urgent mechanisms and intervention. In fact, it's our view that new development finance approaches are required because it's becoming abundantly clear that financial and economic integration is a necessary step for the swift advancement of regional development. Successful economic development will depend on the implementation of African-driven development finance solutions. Development finance and development finance institutions will therefore become critical for supporting the development of the broader financial sector and the regional development process. As it relates to long-term capital for development projects, especially for infrastructure, stimulating industrial development and value add, promoting entrepreneurship, access to capital markets, access to technological finance, financing for agricultural development, and microfinance. In this regard, business welcomes the provisions contained in the protocol for the establishment of the SADC Development Finance Institutions Network and measures to strengthen capacity building and collaboration in the DFI sector across the SADC region. Chairperson, in conclusion, there can be little argument about the need to harmonize finance and investment policies within the SADC region, within the broader global context. Southern Africa cannot afford to squander its limited financial resources as a result of duplication and fragmentation. However, implementation of the SADC protocol will not be an easy task. The challenges around creating a single monetary union, which has been spoken about, the harmonization among central banks, we believe, is not something that can be dealt with overnight, that it requires the dedicated institutional capacity within SADC to be developed, that it requires the strengthening of the resources of the SADC Secretariat in itself, and moreover, that all of that is built on sound and robust domestic policies within SADC member states that create the conditions for national stabilization within economies and therefore stabilization within the broader SADC economy. So unity of purpose at every level, both public and private, is required to address this challenge and to share the sustainable benefits that can be realized from these. This task could undoubtedly be greatly enhanced by the involvement of South Africa and the participation of the South African organized business sector in providing a perspective to the integration initiative that is often lacking in the more political proposals, but which can also be mutually reinforcing and supportive. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you. As I had indicated, that the submission was also forwarded to National Treasury, so if there are any comments, we will get National Treasury to comment on some of the points you have raised. And I take it that you have also covered the one for Busa as well.
If I can just say, Chairperson, there are strong similarities in the submission that I've just read and the overall submission from Busa. Just some particular points that Bruce has asked me to raise, Chairperson, and I'll be very brief. Bruce has noted that not all SADC members are
signatories. If you could just then refer us to the sections of the Bruce submission so that we were
okay.
The Bruce submission is the one that's written 2, Bruce 2, November 2007.
It should be that one, Chairperson, because okay. The Bruce logo on top.
Right. That you are referring to?
That we will be present in our chairperson.
Got general comments, but also has specific
comments. I'll deal with specific comments. Okay. The one general comment is that Busa has picked up the issue that not all SADC member states are signatories to the protocol, which he believes is a possible sign of limited political commitment by some member states. And Busa has lacked clarity on the issue in this regard. Also, Busa, in line with the overall business sentiment, supports the broad stated objectives of the protocol. Chairperson, on the specific comments by Busa relating to, firstly, point A on the fourth page of the Busa submission, the creation of a favorable investment climate within SADC for promoting an attractive investment. Busa has indicated the view that this objective is commendable. However, that SADC should focus on developing the underlying infrastructure and institutional capacity that becomes the base on which such investment climate and investment promotion can be built. Point B, around achieving macroeconomic stability, and this is the point I made earlier to your person, that's the view of business that macroeconomic conversion within SADC must be built on sound member state economic stability. And that will be the key ingredient for achieving macroeconomic convergence. And the creation of a single monetary policy union and such measures would then be informed by that level of stability. It can't happen in isolation of stabilizing economic activity and economies at the member state level. Point C, Busa talks about cooperating in respect of taxation and related matters. It's the view of Busa that tax benefits within the SADC protocol for business doing business in SADC will obviously be beneficial where it creates a business-friendly tax regime. However, Busa has raised question marks around the resources and authorities at an agency level that will take responsibility for such tax regimes that are converged within the SADC region. Point D at the bottom of page 4 of the Busa submission, and it goes on to the beginning of page 5. Busa talks about cooperation and coordination among state parties in collaborating with central banks on exchange control policies. Busa views that this objective is particularly difficult as countries have different and often conflicting exchange rate management policies. In my opening comments, I referred to the variances within SADC member states around finance and investment policies, and that those variances need to be dealt with within the context of integration. Point E is Busa's point around the establishment of a framework for cooperation and coordination among central banks with regards to payment, clearing and settlement systems. Busa believes that this, from the point of view of business doing business in SADC, it will be very useful for achieving regional economic integration flows. The development of a solid framework is, however, important, and its absence may become a systemic risk, not just with regard to functioning of central bank integration within SADC, but more importantly, the broader SADC protocol, particularly with impact on smaller economies, which are trying to build themselves up on the basis of a strong central bank system. And then the last point Busa has made is with regards to cooperation on bank supervision among central banks, and that he believes that such cooperation is central, and again emphasizes that it would be particularly important for smaller countries within SADC, that such cooperation leads to them being able to catapult and piggyback in the development of the internal banking system, so that they can be brought in line for the purposes of convergence a lot quicker. So those are the specific comments chairperson by Busa, but overall, from what I've indicated, the sentiment by business is one of support for the stated objectives of the protocol, that notwithstanding the reservations, we believe that the protocol is a step in the right direction, not just for SADC, but for the continent as a whole, that South Africa, the ratification of the protocol by the South African Parliament, even though it's been signed into effect by the President already, is a very important signaling factor for the region, given South Africa's economic status within the region. and that will be a huge sign of confidence for the direction that SADC is taking, particularly with regards to finance and investment.
Okay, thanks. If there are any questions from commission members that seek to clarify some of the matters raised by BUSA and the BPO, this is an opportunity. And then, in the light of the fact that National Treasury is not yet with us, we will proceed, if there are no questions from members or after dealing with the questions from members, to take the another part of the GEPF. And when National Treasury is around, we will then deal with the formal consideration of the summit protocol. Are there any questions from members with regards to the submission by both sides of the bill? Mr. Mwode.
I just want to find out from both sides if they are involved as far as the project is concerned in economic development within the SADC or in any other investment within SADC or in any development within SADC as good as the usual business people.
Okay,
this chairperson, from the basis of the inputs for the submissions which I've gone through, some of the constituencies represented by the BPO have strong activity and links within the SADC region. South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, which was SACOP before, is strongly affiliated to the SADC Association of Chambers, and is active within that association, promoting the development of the chamber movement within the region as a whole. And obviously South Africa has a lot to demonstrate in terms of the development of the chamber movement. We've got the longest standing chamber movement historically on the continent, but also talking to the rest of the continent about the challenges of economic transformation as it relates to the chamber movement, what's the role of the chamber movement, what's also the role of the chamber movement in economic development broadly within Africa. So at one level, yes, I can also indicate that BUSA, in terms of its own institutional activity, is a member of the SADC Employers Group. It's also a member of the Pan-African Employers Confederation. So BUSA as an institution is involved within economic and business development related activities, not just within SADC, but within the African region broadly. But, you know, chairperson, that's at the level of institutions. I'm certain that you will find, if you were to go drill down into the activity of chamber movement members, businesses on the ground, corporations, even small on the ground, that there would be some interest that those businesses on the ground would have for doing conducting economic activities within the SADC region, whether it would be outsourcing of their production processes, whether it would be sourcing of raw materials, whether it would be the export of goods. And it's with that in mind that the input we made around the impact of the SADC Finance and Investment Protocol on firm level development, how firms on the ground would respond to a very robust SADC Finance and Investment Protocol and the role it would play in firm level decision making.
Yes, Makoto.
Thank you, Chairman. I just want to pose this question. One area that has been touched in the presentation relates to the lack of institutional capacity. I want to check what intervention are you making at BUSA to ensure that terrain is addressed? Because I would suppose that we need some form of partnership from both government and business sector, because this is one area that seems to be, you know, hopped on continuously. What is it that you are doing as organized business to address it? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I certainly think that the ratification of the protocols, the SADC protocol on trade, which is already ratified and in place, which is a key one for business. And protocols such as this one opens up the space effectively for business to start talking, business in South Africa to start talking to business in other SADC member states. As to now that these protocols are in place, how do we as business start coordinating responses across national boundaries to taking, benefiting from the opportunities that this protocol presents? How will we look at opportunities for collaboration across different areas to tap into the benefits that these protocols present to us? I think that's the one issue. The other issue that we are very concerned about that when we talk about institutional capacity is that within SADC, institutions do exist. At the highest level, there is the SADC Secretariat. We believe that the proliferation of protocols, notwithstanding as the necessity for them and as important as they may be, must also be balanced with the view that where do responsibility for these protocols lie? Who ultimately takes responsibility for the implementation? Yes, we acknowledge that there's a collective responsibility, but there's a vagueness in that, that ultimately there needs to be one point where these protocols, the responsibility for the implementation, the monitoring, the continual refinement rests. We believe the strengthening of the SADC Secretariat in that regard is very important. It's a key institution. And as much as these new protocols will come into being and come into effect, existing institutions must be strengthened so that the institutional capacity does not undermine the very objectives of what these protocols are aimed at achieving. The third area that I think is very important is the type of interaction that's happening here now within this committee, where business on the ground, organized business in particular, can advocate to legislators within the SADC region, to parliaments within the SADC regions, to governments within the SADC regions on his views on what he would like seen built into these protocols. A number of these protocols, a lot of the resourcing flows from a state level and a political level, a political organs of SADC. But the interest with regards to making sure that these protocols work, that the market responds, those things happen at the level of the private sector. And so the level of dialogue and advocacy and the space that opens up for that type of dialogue between the private sector and the public sector around these protocols, not just this one, others that may come in the future, is very important. The end result will be that the protocol must be robust, it must have longevity, business must be able to respond to the protocol, take advantage of it, and where business has responsibilities in making sure that the protocols are taken advantage of, that they work in terms of economic activity, and we need to be in a position to do that, and space for dialogue and advocacy in that regard is very important.
Thanks, Mr. Patel. As I indicated, members, we will wait until we have National Treasury with us before the formal consideration of the protocol, because what one would actually want to establish, there are some proposals made by with regard to some of the articles where they propose some amendments, just to actually get the view of National Treasury with regard to what impact that would have and what National Treasury's response is. For instance, in Article 2, there are proposals for amendments, the Article 7.3, there are amendments of the Competition Policy Manual, there are proposed modifications. So when National Treasury comes in, we will then be in a position to first take National Treasury's comments and responses to those before the committee formally considers. We are now going to move on to the GEPF. I'd like to ask the team to take the front seat, and if there is a PowerPoint presentation, if we could also set that up in the middle. Oh, there you go. Right in the front there. The team from the GEPF to present to us on their annual report for the financial year 2006/07 is led by the chairperson of the Board of Trustees, Mr. Martin Couscous. Even if we know the faces, members normally want people to indicate where they are. So if, welcome, Mr. Couscous. And then we have the Chief Executive Officer of the GEPF, Mr. Phineas Chier. And then we have Martin Tikola, who is the Chief Operations Officer, Mr. Tikola. Mr. Bradley Green, Head of Actuaries, GEPF, Bradley, where's Mr. Green? And then we have Mr. Pearl Silvella, Communications Manager, GEPF. Welcome. Your annual report has been circulated to members, and so is your written and your PowerPoint presentation is before the committee as we speak. So without wasting time, if you could just walk us through, and then we'll take questions from members then.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. It is indeed for us a great privilege to submit our, just a synopsis of our annual report this morning. It is the first full cycle of the newly appointed Board of Trustees. We've been appointed in June 2005, so last year we only had half of the year's responsibility, and this was our first take at a full year's responsibility. Now, just a bit of background. The GPF was established in terms of the Government Employees Pension Fund Law. It was through Proclamation 21 of 1996. Members will recall that out of the CODESA negotiation, there were a set of issues that emerged around you know, the civil service security, make sure that their service benefits are retained and so on, and this emanated into this piece of legislation after being debated in the public sector bargaining chamber. This law made provision for the consolidation of nine previous funds, mostly from the PVBC states and a host of other state organs that had their own funds. And the law assigns overall responsibility to a board of trustees. And after a protracted period of negotiations in Nederland, it was ultimately agreed to have a board of 16 members, equally represented by both the employer and member representation. So we have an eight-a-side board, some of us being independently elected by the employer. It is currently the largest pension fund on the continent. And in the Global Investor Magazine survey recently published in August 2007, the GEP now ranks as the seventh largest fund in the world. And it comes with its own complications, being in the top 10 funds because it's quite an unwieldy monster. Currently, we've got in excess of 700 billion rand worth of assets under control, and we'll highlight some of those challenges as you proceed. The board's responsibility is primarily around governance issues to make sure that we act with the highest degree of responsibility because we have a long-term horizon to ensure that people's life savings can at least secure them with a decent pension after retirement. And therefore, there's a host of issues that kicks into the value chain. We need to make sure that funds are collected timelessly, that benefit payments takes place timelessly, that the correct investment strategy is pursued to make sure that the fund's liabilities and its assets can match. And we're also subjected to a whole host of other regulatory requirements. We currently have about 1.14 million contributing members, and about 303,000 pensioners that we're servicing. And in terms of the current arrangement, members contribute 7.5% of their pensionable salary, and the employer contributes about 13% for civil servants, but for the uniformed forces, there's an additional premium they get subsidized to the tune of 16%. We currently have a self-administered fund, though moving forward that situation will change, and we will highlight it later on. And the nature of the fund currently is a defined benefit fund, which means if things go wrong, the employer, by definition, the state here, needs to make good for any shortfall in the fund. Our core functions include member admissions, contribution collections, maintaining the proper database, making sure that withdrawals take and during exits take place within the rules, that the necessary benefits and annuity payments take place, and that the fund's assets is invested in such a way that we can meet our future liabilities. We have mandated another organ of state, the Public Investment Corporation, to manage the investments on our behalf, because we don't want to become asset managers. We want a clear distinction between the roles of the asset owner and the asset manager. And currently, the PIC total portfolio, we constitute about 92.3% of the total investments under the administration of the PIC. We also administer medical subsidy for pensioners, injury on duty, the non-statutory forces and special pension projects on behalf of National Treasury, commonly called Program 8. These are benefit suites. There's some retirement benefits for normal retirement, early retirement, ill health and other retirement, late retirement, payment of gratuity to beneficiaries, as well as death benefits, resignation benefits, and funeral benefits. Now, Jefferson, after a long and protracted negotiation process with our multi-fund manager, the PIC, we ultimately have, for the first time, a very elaborate investment mandate. We got the concurrence of the Minister of Finance for the broader policy framework, and the detailed work has been captured in quite a voluminous document. But just some of the key features of that investment policy: we believe that we must have a diversified portfolio with strategic asset allocation to maintain long-term funding levels of 100% and minimize fluctuations in the employer contribution rate. Prior to the dawn of democracy, in 1994, government inherited a fund that was by then only 69% funded. You will recall, Chairperson, that the Public Investment Commission, as it was called by then, was a convenient kind of a slush fund or during the days of sanctions and economic boycotts against South Africa, and the pension fund was a very, very favorable territory where the state by then bolstered its administrative capability. And we're proud that 13 years down the line, we have reached 100% funding level. We will show to you how it was brought about, and we want to maintain it so that we minimize any fund flux. Given the nature of our fund being a defined benefit fund, we don't want to put undue pressure again on the fiscus and indirectly, by definition, the taxpayer. We also believe that we need to finance the emerging sectors of the South African economy and also promoting economic well-being in Africa in general. Given the leverage that we have on the economic landscape, we've got a transformational goal to achieve and support government in its quest to transform the socio-economic landscape of this country. But last year we had our first take at in pursuit of NEPA objectives, where we were founding members of the Pan-African Infrastructure Development Fund, where for the first time in the history of the continent, African investment houses and pension funds pooled their money together. The first close generated $642 million, and we've put down seed capital of $250 million to make sure that we assist with the establishment of economic infrastructure on the continent to advance the cause of NIFAN. We also believe in our investment policy that we've got a responsibility for the development of capacity and intellectual capital of the investment management industry in South Africa. And therefore, we've instructed our asset managers, the PIC. You might have seen recently, they've mopped up about 90-odd billion rand, from which was in excess, a passive, part of the passive portfolio that some of our asset managers were warehousing, and we've mopped that up with a specific purpose to bring in BEE companies. There are quite a few nice boutiques out there that needs our support, some niche service providers that we want to bring into the net as well. The fourth anchor of our investment policy is that we will direct our efforts in such a manner that it does not cause undue market impact either on registers and changes or at macroeconomic level. Given the size of our fund, whatever we do can have a domino effect on the macroeconomic environment, and therefore we would like to be very prudent in our approach. And as I normally tell people, we're not on a taxi rank where we can make quick turns and quick stops. We're steering a ship on an ocean, and we need to be focused, because 1 degree out of line can have serious and adverse implications, not only for the fund, but the macroeconomic environment of the country. In just highlighting some of the issues of the past year, we're proud to report that we've awarded pension increases that fully compensated all pensioners for inflation adjustments since retirement. So pensioners are not worse off. Our pension increases have been as such that it factored in all inflationary pressures on our members' pension. As already mentioned, we've committed $250 million into Africa through the Pan-African Infrastructure Development Fund. We have agreed the pension increase and funding level policy with the Minister of Finance, which was informed by proper actuarial evaluation, and we're also busy with the asset liability modeling to make sure that the assets can balance out the liability as we move forward with some of these increases. We concluded a comprehensive investment mandate with the PIC. Some of these things include clear risk and return parameters, optimized portfolio construction methodology, independent investment monitoring, because the PIC can't be a referee and player at the same time. There needs to be an independent oversight to make sure that we get the best return for investments there, but also independent investment administration, independent custody appointments, and clear shareholder engagement policy. Now, Jefferson last year on the 27th of April, and quite significantly on the 27th of April, the GPF was invited by the then Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Kofi Annan, as part of the Global Compact Initiative. We were one of 36 founding signatories, the world's top funds assembled at the New York Stock Exchange to sign the United Nations Charter on for Principles on Responsible Investment. And I represented the GPF there, and the 36 funds assembled there collectively represented $2.4 trillion. So South Africa was indeed in big company then. And as we quote here, the Secretary General stated on that day that today is increasingly clear that the UN objectives, that's peace, security, development, go hand in hand with prosperity and growing markets. If societies fail, so will markets. And we feel, as a board of trustees, we've committed ourselves to these principles of responsible investment. And these are the things that we will vigorously pursue. We will incorporate environmental, social, transformation, and governance issues into investment analysis and decision-making processes. We will be active owners. In the past, the GEPF was a passive shareholder. We're moving from passivity to being active owners and incorporating ESG issues into our ownership policies and practices. So whoever manages our assets, wherever we invest, there should be due regard for environmental sustainability, social transformation, and top-level governance practices there. We will also seek appropriate disclosure on ESG issues by the entities in which we invest. We will also promote acceptance and implementation of the principles within the investment industry. South Africa has been asked to spearhead this drive on the continent there's an emerging market program, but the focus will be on Brazil, South Africa, and Thailand. And we've already, just last week I was in Cape Town, where a couple other asset managers also signed up now for these principles on responsible investment. We will work together to enhance our effectiveness in implementing the principles, and each of our reports on activities in progress will demonstrate the level of implementation of these principles. Just some of the financial highlights. We have again received an unqualified audit report. Our accumulated reserves grew to 658 billion in 2007. That's just under 121% increase on the previous year. We have, as I've earlier alluded, we've reached now a funding level of 100% as of 31st March 2006. Now, we normally do an actuarial evaluation every 3 years, and this year we're up for an evaluation in 2007, a much more thorough and rigorous one. And when I met with the Minister of Finance the other day, he hinted to me, Chairperson, when can I apply for my contribution holiday? He's expecting a contribution holiday moving forward because there is some indication that we might be having a surplus if the robust performance of equities can be sustained. And just to highlight, our investments over the last 3 years respectively grew at 20.7, 31.3, and for last year 20.7 again. And our investment income just for last year amounted to 116 billion rand, and the contributions received amounted to 22.7 billion and benefits awarded to 24 billion rand. This is just a graphic illustration on how these two, the green and blue colors, are matching now. You will observe, chiefs and honorable members, that in the 1996, our assets were lower than our liabilities, and we've gradually narrowed that gap, and now we can meet all our liabilities, as this graph illustrates. There are ever challenges, and what are these challenges? Firstly, at an institutional level, we have agreement now with the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Finance is in discussion with the Minister of Public Service and Administration, to separate the administration of the fund from the governance of the fund. We will have an administrative component that will just deal with the fund administration, and the Board of Trustees will primarily focus on issues of governance, benefit administration, the whole question of investment, and making sure that we also meet all the necessary legal compliance. Iran itself will pose tremendous challenges because as we move over into new institutional model, almost similar like your social security agency, your SARS and so on, that will report directly, there need to be tight service level agreements between the board and the new agency so that standards are maintained and that our members are not adversely affected. We've also seen as a second challenge legislative reform. The current GPF law emanates from 1996, and even in this committee, I'm sure the whole pension fund reform debate has resonated in this committee, and we also need to make sure that we align our efforts and our activities to synchronize with the legislative reforms that are taking place in this country around pension funds.
But at the risk of sounding predictable, Jefferson, skills is an issue.
And this is an issue of the whole financial services industry. As your economy grows, you also grow and you also run into capacity issues here, where these skills are fairly mobile and fairly marketable. And we had a very disjointed structure. You had a pocket of employers seconded by National Treasury. You had a pocket of employers which we've inherited from the former TDDC states that were never formally adopted into the structure. Then a large component of contract workers. The CEO can explain later, but a bulk of his time was taken up on exit interviews the last couple of months because people in the climate of uncertainty didn't want to stay on, and hence our pursuit now to have certainty through a new institutional architecture. The whole notion of shareholder activism is also to us a major challenge. All over the world, there's an emergence of a new class of, I just read a book recently, The New Capitalist, where ordinary men and women are taking charge now in the boardrooms of this world, where ordinary men and women are now realizing the leverage and power that they have because it's their pension funds that drive the investment strategies and the growth of a lot of these big multinational corporations. And we need to make sure, given the size and the quantum of our portfolio in the GPF, that we hold people accountable to governance, to social transformation, and environmental issues. Just last week, we were hit by a major revelation on the bread price. Members have seen this pronouncement on by the Competition Commission. Now, we own shares in that company that was found guilty. Clearly, there's a governance issue at stake here. Now, the fine has been paid, but indirectly, we pay the fine as the GPF because we own part of that company, quite a substantial part of that company. And therefore, you will see our coming to the fore much more forcefully in our pronouncement where there are governance lapses, where there are social transformation obstruction, and where people have a disregard for environmental sustainability. And we have now, we've recruited a full-time individual that will deal with the measurement instruments, the policy frameworks and so on will be narrowed down to clear deliverables, and we will actually publish these things. To a large extent, the public should be informed, especially the 1.3 million pensioners, who by definition owns the very company last week that was revealed that took money away from them by charging them higher for bread. So these are the type of things that we need to start getting involved with. There are also legacy processes and systems. We are busy with a major business process re-engineering so that we do things quicker, faster, and our response time is much more shortened. But we also need to, and that's why we've appointed the communications manager to make sure that there's greater relationship management and client service. We've also appointed people that takes care now on in our regions, liaising directly with employee department, with employee departments at provincial level, at national level, so that the interface there can be much more mutually beneficial. But proactive risk management is also a major challenge for us. We know that the market can, at any turn, just on speculative rumor, can take a bit of a tumble, and we need to be sensitive to all these things, pick up the signals timelessly, and mitigate these risks through the correct asset portfolio that we construct. And the exit turnaround times, especially the time of submission of documentation. Jefferson recently, the public protector held a public hearing on why pensioners are waiting so long for their money. And it is very clear, and we will even demonstrate to you here that a lot of these, a lot of these documents are sent back to the employer. I can imagine there is Mrs. So-and-so who worked in a rural school for 39 years, having given service to government. On the day of her pension, the whole bureaucracy from the principal's office to the district office to the regional office to head office until it reached the pension fund, and then it arrives there and still documents are not correctly filled in. It goes back to that principal. In the meantime, ladies waiting for money, but we're also bound by certain FICA requirements and all these other regulatory things. If we don't get the correct information, and we can't pay out. And consistently, every month, at least 2,000 error documents are sent back to employers. Now, that's got a snowball effect, and the backlogs keep on increasing. And that to us is a major challenge. We have now proactively engaged with employers, but we're not employing them, so we're not in charge of the HR person in a specific department, and at best we can engage, at best we can empower, at best we can make sure that people have an understanding of our requirements. And Jefferson, I think we will be well served if also at this level where parliamentarians do their constituency work, where they interface with the public, that if things come to your attention, we value your criticism, we're here to serve, to value your input, and I think at the end of the day, we must make sure that we don't erode the quality of life of our pensioners if we don't unblock some of these bureaucratic measures. That's our presentation, Jefferson. We're open for questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Kuskus. There we have it, members. When you spoke about the error documents sent to employer, the Z102, there is a slide just prior to that one which talks about the exit backlog. I thought you were going to talk to that slide also. You spoke about the error documents sent to employer. I would be happy if you also just, explained that the aspect of the slide, because I think the two are related. Are there any additions that members of the team want to make before we take questions or clarity from members and comments? No. Okay. Members, Mr. Malato, if you are here. Mr. Mbone, Mr. Chancellor, Ms. McCarter, and Ms. Otten. Thank you, Chairperson. I would want to refer the presenter to page 48 of the annual report. I just want to establish a few facts here. You say that your estimation at this stage indicates that you are 100% funded. Those are the preliminary results. But my question that I would want to put to you is that if you look at the table 12, it raises a number of critical questions. One, you haven't as yet determined the solvency reserve for the fund. And I'm talking about the year 2005 to 2006, not yet even 2006-2007. That has not been determined. Second issue around that, just as part of one question, your surplus deficit has not yet been determined. And even in your explanation on page 49, you're indicating that the 2007 adjustment took effect after 2006 valuation and goes on further. The difficulty that I have is one. How then do you come to the point to say that you're 100% funded when you can't even determine your own solvency reserve, your surplus or deficit? That's the major problem that I'm having with this report. The second set of issues that I have a problem with. Still on the issues of your liability, I would say part of the thing. You are saying in your page 23 that significant progress report was made to the verification of employer and member information in the contact base. You are still verifying the information. You don't have the exact information. Your membership. And how are you going to be able to determine your liability? Chair, I would want to go to the last I'm just trying to clap it together because they should be able to make sense. It's on your internal audit function and risk management. Because in one of your pages, I'd say it's page 28 of your report. Page 28 of your report, you know, under governance and legislation, you say the GPF needs to integrate a comprehensive risk management strategy into its operation. The inability to diligently identify and mitigate major business risks on a continual basis has created challenges. You know, for me, that's a major statement. And I want you to assist us to understand what are you doing about the statement. You had outsourced your internal budget, and now you've taken the measures to ensure that you do it in-house. But to me, this is a major statement. And we are putting all these questions because finally, this thing becomes a risk to the fiscus. And we want to have a comprehensive 1,000.
Okay. That was just not a mess.
Thank you, Chair.
And can I request that you indicate when you think that perhaps we've overloaded you with questions so that we because I would want us to get, answers, elaborate answers. At times when we're taking too many questions, it becomes difficult to give elaborate answers. But let's take the second one. Mr. Azir.
Chair, one is a technical question, which I want to clear it. In the report, for instance, in page 48, you speak about 2006 and 2004. Maybe you have to look into it when the public reads the report. I assume this is an annual report of 2006 and 2007. So whether is it a typical graphical mistake or not, or trying to mislead the
court. What page of page was that, Mr.?
Page 48.
48, okay.
Yeah. Then, just Chairperson, to ask a question of the audit. I don't dispute the credibility of the auditor. But the question I'm raising is that why are you not audited? The auditors are not instructed by the auditor general. And secondly, are you accounting in terms of the PSLA? Because when you account in terms of the PSLA, the question of Mr. Muloto, Honorable Member Mr. Muloto, will kick in terms of your internal audit, which is a problem here, which we need an explanation why, as to why you are not audited by your audit report should, is not going to the Auditor General's office. The other one is that in terms of your risk management, your trustees somewhere here in the report, page 21, it said that they are not attending training, never attended a trustees training course. In terms of your risk management, how do you have members of the Board of Trustees who don't attend the training? And if they don't attend the training, are they making a meaningful contribution so that the fund can be run according to what it's supposed to be? But for now, Chairperson, I will end there. Thank you.
For now, you have exhausted your set of issues. Let's take the last one, Mr. Mgoni, and then we'll take the next match, which would be Mr. Johnson and Mr. Mokoto. Mr. Mgoni.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to take off where Mr. Asiya left on the risk. I see, of course, all the committees are going to your board, but I don't see any risk committee there or on your board.
Yes.
I know you missed out. It was officially dealt with in the committee and ratified. Go ahead, Darren.
Chairperson, on page 58 of the report, it's got your investment strategy. An investment strategy. I see there you've got the under 2.2, the last bullet, other instruments. I just find out what other instruments are there, which is also one question here, also on the structured investment product. What are these other structured investment products? And the chairperson, my last question is on the same page, where the talking of strategic asset allocation is to be reviewed on the forthcoming financial year and so forth. My question here is, has this been done before? Or if it's not been done before, why are you doing it now? Because I think you're going to be doing it when you give a money to PIC. Just want to say, why was it done before? If not, why is it being done now? That's all for now.
Okay, can we get responses to those questions before we move on to the next set of things?
There were some
So these particular numbers refer then obviously to the previous valuation, whereas the financial statements will obviously always refer to the previous financial year. Just in terms of the actual valuation and the determination of the solvency reserve, one can point out first of all that you would note that the net assets of the fund on table 12 are 545 billion. Relative to total liabilities of 447 billion. The surplus, therefore, based on those numbers without the determination of the solvency reserve, is 124% funded. So one though needs to do a comprehensive asset liability model, and as a result of the fact that this was an interim valuation, the board agreed to take the time to do a fully comprehensive asset liability model to determine an appropriate level of solvency. The level of solvency, it reflects the fact that the market has indeed run significantly over the last 3 years and that we do take risk in the portfolio. And I think this also is partly addresses the issue of a stop loss. The level of solvency is determined in order to, the magnitude of which is determined in order to, at some degree of confidence, give the trustees comfort that if markets do crash or something happens, the first port of call would be your level of, it would be your solvency reserve. And so in determining the solvency reserve, it's intuitive that the solvency reserve would be somewhere between the naught or fully funded position and 24% of the fund, which is the effective surplus, although we can't really say it's a surplus because the solvency reserve is used to build up your liability. So to the extent that the solvency reserve builds up to 24%, then the fund would still be fully funded. And it would not be intuitive to have a solvency reserve larger than 24% because then you would be effectively moving into, although it's not insolvent, but you'd be moving into an underfunded position with a large level of solvency. So I hope that addresses the question around the solvency issue.
I can follow up on that one, on the response, okay.
Chairperson, a follow-up on the question. As much as I understand the gentleman responding on the question of 2006 and 2004, if you follow the report, the way which you have to report in terms of the statute, then there's a column which is left, 2005, where is it?
Another follow-up, Mr. Lott, maybe there's
I think later. Still maybe we might have, if there's still time, we might have to pursue it later, because it still doesn't answer my question. The solvency reserve is not determined here. What is the gentleman is telling me are his assumptions. Because if they were not his assumptions, they would be contained reflected in the report. They would be reflected in the book. So those are his assumptions.
Okay.
Chairperson, let me just reiterate this once. I think in my input I said in terms of the law, we need to do an actuarial valuation every 3 years. The last one was done in 2004, and therefore these figures are definitive for 31st March 2004, because that's the last time that was done. In terms of the law, we must now do in 2007, this current financial year, an actuarial valuation and an asset liability modeling. That work is already far advanced. But you can see on page 47, on an annual basis we've done interim actuarial evaluations by reputable institutions to assist us before we do the statutory one of 3 years to give us a level of comfort as to where we stand with the fund. So we must effectively report them after 3 years, in terms of the law. In the next subsequent report, we will do that.
Okay, well, we shall proceed.
It's quite an involved issue, yeah. You know, to deal with these things.
So the the current valuation that we are expecting is the one that was done at the 31st of March 2007, which is not reflected in this report.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's proceed. We'll flag some of these issues and perhaps we'll get back to them. Okay. Further responses. Now on the database, what we are referring to is the fact that the data on which we compile our database comes from the department. But from time to time, what happens is, especially in the departments of health and education, they employ temporary teachers, temporary nursing staff, and they enroll them into the pension fund. But when they exit, when their time slot elapses, what they do, they don't inform us that these people have left. They just stop contributing. So our challenge there is to make sure that once we see that people have exited, we must check why have they exited without any exit documentation. So it is pragmatic for us now to start making a reconciliation. So our data is not always clean. That's what we're referring to. We continuously try to clean this data by engaging department, because on our own we cannot prejudge that these people have indeed acted as a system. So that's what we are referring to in this instance. That the data that we have is not always clean because of this problem.
What you're saying is that if you were called upon today to give us an accurate number of your members, you would not be able to.
Yeah, because there will be always that deficiency which we won't know until first time that we get the department. But the margin is not that big, because it's on the two big departments, health and education. Now on the risk. Now on the risk management, the comprehensive risk by the board has been completed, but beyond after the 14 period. And before that, we were using a consultancy firm called Deloitte to do the enterprise-wide risk, but the internal audit and the internal management risk. So that's what they've been doing, but the enterprise-wide risk has now been completed after this reporting period by the board. But just to indicate, Chairperson, that the reason why it has been completed so late is because the board only came into being June 2005. So they were taking time to assess and to make sure that they understand the environment. In terms of whether we report to the Public Finance Management Act or whether we also are subject to the Auditor General, just to say that I think the Chairperson in his input indicated that we are governed by the Government Employees Pension Law. So in terms of that law, we are not subject to the PFMA. We are supposed to appoint our own auditors, not Auditor General. So we are auditors structured through the governance of this law. But the Chairperson has also indicated that from next year there will be that separation. The administration is going to fall into the Ministry of Finance. Then, at that stage, it will fall under PFMA, and we will be audited as an administration, audited by the Auditor General. But the governance side will still be audited by this set of private auditors. That is the arrangement, Chair.
That arrangement and the change, are you envisaging a change in the legislation? Or does the legislation as it stands accommodate such flexibility with regard to splitting?
The Minister, the law as it stands now just starts us to set up an administration. As to the where the administration, sometimes people outsource these things, sometimes people do it in-house, sometimes they set up a specialized agency. We're going to set up a specialized agency that will operate more or less like the Social Security Agency, but it will be aware. And there is now, in terms of the new public service act, provision for the specialized agent. What do they call it? Organizational complement.
Yes.
Yes, organizational complement.
I think it's a discussion that we should actually engage in further because, you know, what I pick up is that you're saying that the legislation is silent about it, which means the decision entirely rests upon the...
It's one of those laws that didn't even go through Parliament, Jefferson, and that's why in my input I said, yes.
Members are not surprised when we hear that.
That's why in my input I said that one of the challenges is to align our activities with the legislative reform that's taking place in the pension fund area. That to us is a challenge.
I was saying that
that's a matter that we have to discuss with the National Treasury about the legislation. Because there are other bigger issues also. It's around the regulation of the fund. Because it's not regulated by the financial service board.
No.
So that's a critical matter. Because financial service board, even in terms of these issues of the valuation that I'm raising critical issues on, the financial service board would have commented on that. And said we have gone through it, they would have done their own, actual. Who would have said, I certify this statement to be correct. But at this stage, nobody does that. Because even the auditors of this fund have not expressed an opinion on that, on the actual valuation. So it's raising seriousness issues.
Let's rush to conclude this meeting. Some of the issues that are beginning to come up are issues that I would want us to really tie them down properly at the end of this engagement, because this engagement should assist us also in deciding how we take the process forward, because I know it won't be easy for you to ask yourselves to ask us to subject you to the PFMA, to subject you to the pension fund act. But we have a responsibility as legislators to ensure that is done. But let's not rush to conclude this meeting. You guys have come down here to spend the day with us.
Yes,
just a response to the other question.
I've seen the order paper. We're the only committee to appear after the NIFA.
But we're also going to need time also to finalize the protocol. But proceed before we break with us tonight.
Jefferson, in response to the question that the members are not, only two training sessions were conducted, and one will have to appreciate a lot of these members, these are not full-time members, and it also depends on the availability of these members. Some of the training, we tried to make it coincide with some of the board committees so that people don't have to travel, but there's a drastic improvement from the last two training sessions. I personally attended more training than this, than what has been recorded here, and would like members to watch next year's report around it. Mr. Honorable Nguni, the risk is not reflected, but it's under finance audit and risk. But the risk comment activities take place under the finance committee.
Okay, before you move on to the next question.
The issue of training, the explanation is unacceptable. Because this is a huge fund, we're talking about billions of rand. And if people don't attend training, I find that to be unacceptable. It can't be an excuse that they are part-time. I'm a trustee of a pension fund board. You know, I had to prioritize, for example, in my case, I had to prioritize this meeting. Members are attending training. And we have to be diligent as trustees of the board. But to be given an explanation that this is part-time, I'm part-time also in my board. I'm not full-time. I find the explanation to be unacceptable.
Yes. Jefferson, let me just qualify. Before this board was appointed, we spent 4 days in Muldersdorf with the best brains in this country to acquaint ourselves with all the pension legislation, all the statutory things,
around pension funds. I'm fully confident that the board as it is now, it's fully aware of all its statutory requirements to exercise its duty. There, however, specialized training, what was the last one, how to read financial statements that we recently held by KPMG, needs expressed by the board members. But in as far as the role of trustees are concerned, everybody went through a proper induction course 4 days intensively. Some of our members are actually studying through these things, and some of these things not reflected here does not mean that people are not okay with their responsibilities. They went through a very intensive process of 4 days of training. National Treasury, Financial Services Board, they were all there in Mulder's.
But then the report. Yes, that's the thing. The report.
That was in the previous year.
Yes, but now in the report here, you know, what is of concern to members is that in the report, 17 out of the 30 never attended a single one. And that's real cause for concern for the members. And I think it's important that members, they express this concern if the note is taken off and something is done.
In addition to what you are saying, the other remaining members, they attended either one or two training sessions as opposed to what the chairperson is saying. So it's totally contradictory in terms of the report.
Okay, we've read that. We proceed. It forms part of our report also. Let's proceed with the next set of issues.
Thank you, through the chair. Just to address the question on page 58, the question is raised, three of them, one with regard to other investment instruments. The other investment instruments, as it's reflected there, pertains to the instruments that are held in the buyer portfolio, which includes unlisted instruments, private equity type instruments, fund of fund type instruments. The structured investment product was a set of investments that came about prior to the current Board of Trustees. They have been managed out at the moment. The fund used to hold what was called guaranteed funds, and these guaranteed funds had very long terms on them, and the public investment commissioners in those days before the corporation converted those guaranteed funds into these structured investment products with much better terms for exit. And they're currently managing the fund out of these type of products. They are products that hold derivative type instruments, and they're not optimal for the portfolio, but they are from the past, and the Public Investment Commission Corporation now are continuing to manage them out of the portfolio. In terms of the question with regard to the strategic asset allocation, the current Board of Trustees, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, reviewed the asset allocation last year, and as a consequence of the final asset liability modeling that is currently being performed, there will be another review of the strategic asset allocation together with the Minister of Finance. So that would occur prior to the end of this financial year again.
Just a follow-up, Jefferson. What has been agreed by the Minister and ourselves as percentages of the portfolio is that we, on equity, will have an upper limit. The proposed strategic percentage there will be 51% in equity, 31% in bonds, 5% in property, 5% in cash and money market instruments, and 2% in structured investment products. You can see these derivative stuff and so on is towards the lower end. The bulk of it is mostly in equities, bonds, and property.
Is it a follow-up?
Just a follow-up, Chair. I just want to know, I don't hear your stop-loss strategy, because your stop-loss strategy, because if you have 2% with 9.3% in equities, those are shares, what is your stop-loss strategy? And too much exposure.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, if I may, just attempt to respond. The strategic asset allocation, and yes, I think there's been a remarkable increase in equities over the last 10-year period. We come from a very low equity exposure. The strategic asset allocation is based on a longer-term view that that equities will give an equity risk premium over the longer term. In order to prevent a level of downside, the board is making provision for the solvency reserve, which work is still to be concluded in consultation with the Ministry of Finance. That solvency reserve is intended in the shorter term to create a buffer for market volatility in the shorter term, but in the longer term, it is expected that the markets will outperform. So that is really the effective stop loss strategy, together with a risk budgeting process that has been concluded as part of the mandate of the Public Investment Corporation, which effectively is in putting together or compiling the portfolio within each of these asset classes. The Public Investment Corporation works within predefined limits of risk in terms of what the fund can tolerate.
I have all questions been responded to before I go. I proceeded my list. Okay. I had hands already from Mr. Johnson. One of the things you mentioned with regards to shareholder activism and the issue with regards to the company that had been found guilty of price fixing on bread, you mentioned the issue that in actual fact, the fund was part of paying the fine. But is it true also that the fund also benefited from the illegal loot? Therefore, you had to pay. You had to pay the fine. Mr. Johnson, you had your hand up, and Ms. McCoy.
Thanks, I almost interjected myself too when an announcement was made by the chairman that they have plans afoot to change, you know, the manner in which things are being done from GPS is concerned. I almost said equally we have plans as well to change how you do things. Maybe two quick ones here. I was also grappling with a very simple question that says, what does it mean to say government employee? What does that include? Does that include nurses, teachers, police, army, and over and above civil servants who are? Maybe that's a very simple question. The other question for me, which could be related to that, on page 30, you are mentioning something there.
Next page?
30 of the annual report.
30. Okay.
That's our pronoun, 30. That you have a set of calls that have been registered and visitors that came through. To an extent, you did mention something about the cycle in which responses are expected on any inquiry. I would be very interested to understand the nature of satisfaction out of those inquiries that have been lodged. Both through your call centers and also through people coming through to visit the month as you had registered, you know, you have given their figure. That's the first one. The second one, Chair, maybe the question raised earlier on about the numbers, the members that you have on your database of what is called government employee pensioners. How many? Maybe for me, what's important there is more about the extent in which these members are informed about their benefits. whether this is monthly, this is, you know, biannual, this is annually. We do receive from time to time statements that indicate to us as to what is our status, what is our situation, pension-wise. Whether these members that are in your database do receive, and how do you communicate with them from time to time? The last one, say, on your page 57 of your annual report, you had set aside in sometime 2001 what you refer to as some aimed at addressing past, you call it past discriminatory practices for members of your non-secretary force. What had actually happened to this? Whether any satisfactions were did prevail out of these processes. Linked to that, as you mentioned in your presentation on the second slide, GEPF has approximately 1.14 million contributing members. Maybe that should be answering partly your question, the question I've asked earlier on. Will this include, because the social pensions have just concluded its business as of 31st of December last year, and one of the resolutions out of that, or rather one of the stipulations out of that act, mentioned the fact that those beneficiaries would be actually transferred to the government employee pension fund. Has that happened? Are those included in those members you just made mention of in your report here?
Ms. Pocket.
Thank you, Shatoku. I'll ask a few questions. I want to check, recently we have had an amendment to the Pension Fund Act, of which the Act gave members of different pension funds the right to transfer or move about their funds from one fund to the other. I want to check to what extent has this affected the membership of the fund. Secondly, on page 25, we talk about the communication and stakeholder relationship. Basically, the question that I want to ask relates to how do you regard, to what extent do you regard yourself as transparent as an organization? Particularly, you must relate your question, your answer to that transparency. How does it operate with regard to members knowing the value of their funds? And then also attached to that is, do you have procedures that exist for members to raise complaints or queries about the activities of yourselves as a pension fund or the other people where you have invested? The other thing that comes to the fore relates to women in your organization. Your board of trustees has got only two women. Why? Why do you have that? As we understand that government calls for that government policy calling for women empowerment. Maybe Chairperson also ask a question that relates to youth empowerment. You don't talk about the learnership, you don't talk about the mentor mentorship or whatever that you program that you might be having for youth. Why are you not engaging in such activities? Because we know that there is skill shortage in the country, especially within this area. And then why are you spending less on adult training? Why are they not your priorities, whereas this is government priority? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Listening attentively to the Chairperson's input presentation, then one quick one comes to mind. Very, very small one here. Page 55. I'm trying to find the meaning here. What is the meaning of this statement? We do not express an opinion on the financial condition of GEPF from an actuarial point of view. I mean, as a non-fundi on this issue, I just want to ask them precisely that statement in the light of the chairperson's assertion that you have unqualified. This one.
Can I take two more? That's still okay. It's not yet done. Ms. Fox?
Thank you, Comrade. Thank you, Chairperson. As you know, I was at another meeting. But thank you for allowing me the time now. On page 46, this question may well have been asked and answered. You were responding when I came in, perhaps on investments and so on. In particular, I wanted to get a further clarification on what is called here as socially responsible investment. The fact that you thought it would appear to be generating your own policy in this particular direction. That's what I'm being led to understand on page 46. And the other question is to do with the benefits, the unclaimed benefits, which are referred to on page 13. Again, the same thing. If you have answered this, please understand I wasn't aware. Now, what measures do you take? As you say, you know, you try for 3 years or whatever, you know, these are unclaimed for a period of 3 years, it then accrues back into the fund. What measures have you implemented to try and locate the beneficiaries? I would be interested to hear that. Thank you.
Can I take responses and then I'll come to the next set of hands that I have? And there was a question about the benefit statement that was asked. And earlier on, you indicated that at times you have situations where people, especially with teachers and nurses that are employed on a temporary basis, but then that are enrolled into the GEPF. Perhaps it would be interesting to hear how you handle that when it comes to the issuing of benefit statements, if you do issue benefit statements of people that only come in for a short period of time.
Okay, Chairperson, whilst my team is getting ready to respond to the more difficult ones, I'll try and respond to the definitional one as asked by Honorable Johnson, what does GEP and government employees include? Includes the level of employment for national, provincial, plus all the uniformed forces, local government excluded. You know, your police, your army, defense forces, correctional services. No, provincial, the nurses are, the nurses of provincial, teachers of provincial departments, as well as some of the national health and education officials as well. All the national departments, all the provincial departments, and the uniformed forces. The other question that Honorable Makoto has asked about the recent amendment to the Pension Fund Act, it didn't affect us at all. We govern by the GPF law, and members, in terms of the employment condition, they must be members of the Government Employee Pension Fund once they join the government. There are only two women in the organization. The bad news, there's not a single one in the organization at the moment. Let's tell you how the board is constituted. The unions and the pensioners nominate 8 people. We can't prescribe to them who they must nominate. It's a NERLAC process. So we write to them and say, there's a vacancy now, so-and-so is left. We would prefer that you know appoint to deal with the gender balance that the unions nominate 8. The sad news, the government also nominates 8. So we just nominated by the employer. See, you're speaking to the wrong person. We haven't constituted the board. It's government. By definition here, the Minister of Public Service Administration and the Minister of Finance have got a key role in the appointment of the employer portion of the trustees. The unions, they've got their own consultative processes there to make representation. We lost Ms. Belle Rankin now. She was from Public Service and Administration. She's now been appointed at SASA, the Social Security Agency. She's gone. Rhonda Stewart is also, she appears here as a trustee, but she's also no more there. She was an independent trustee. There's also this thing of learnership and youth empowerment. In my earlier input, I made you aware of the dysfunctional structure where there were seconded officials from National Treasury, contract workers, and so on. The board has now signed off this year on a formal learnership program. That learnership program will take on board the concerns that you've expressed, you know, to get more young people into the system. Honorable member, this is Mabuya Mbili. From an actuarial point of view, they can't express an opinion, the auditors here, because we hinted earlier on that the actuarial valuation will only be done this year. So they can't express an opinion on the actuarial status of the fund until such time that the actuarial valuation, which is due for this 3-year term, has been concluded. And that's why they put that note in there. They can't express an opinion because there was no actuarial valuation. Honorable Fox, the socially responsible investment, as I've stated in my input, we are now signatories to the UN Charter on Responsible Investment, where we are looking at the GSE issues, governance, social transformation, as well as environmental sustainability. And we will encourage investment strategies that will bring about issues like environmental sustainability. There's a whole movement throughout the world now on a greater consciousness on energy efficiency. People are talking about carbon points and all these type of things. And as I alluded in my input, we've appointed a specialist now that will assist us in measuring those things and that will actually, you know, profile these companies that conduct their business in a very environmentally sustainable way, but also companies that deal with some of the social transformational issues here.
Okay, yeah, I have a response to communication.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. And Honourable Member Johnson, on the issue of the walk-in centre and the nature of calls that we receive, we currently have two primary channels, which is the call centre and the walk-in centre at our head office at Hamilton Street. And from our analysis, the reason we're receiving so many calls at our call center and so many food visiting our walk-in center is because we are thinly spread, and we've come to the conclusion that we are inaccessible to the members that we are serving. And to this regard, we have now had plans to roll out regional plans and satellite offices in consultation with the employer department where we best serve them. These plans have been approved by the board on the 1st of November and are due for rollout in the next financial year. But in the remaining 3 months, what we'll be doing, we'll be making sure that the existing 3 regional offices are empowered in a way that they'll be able to serve the employer department and the members close to them, not as a mere post office, but that they are linked with the head office back-end system. And we afford them an enabling technology that will minimize or shorten the turnaround time. And also with regard to the nature of calls that we receive both at the call center and at the walk-in center, upon scrutiny, we realize that the nature of calls that we are receiving are absolutely not necessary. And as part of introspection, we have realized that there's a dire need for member education and employer training and liaison. And in the regional offices, these are some of the key activities that will take place to make sure that we reduce on the number of calls that we are receiving by educating our members, by making sure that the employers do impart the correct knowledge to the members, beneficiaries, and the offense. The primary roles of the regional offices will be that of community outreach, member education, query resolution, not to post the query to the health office, member tracing and investigation, employer education and training, customer relationship management, case assessment and validation. So those regional offices will make sure that when documentation comes from the employer department within those surroundings, those cases are validated, they are assessed before they even send for processing in order to reduce the turnaround time. And also we'll put mechanisms in place to solicit feedback on an ongoing basis. We do not have those formal channels currently. And another important attribute of this new CRM that we're rolling out is that there will be a formal, independent customer satisfaction monitoring by an independent body, not power, sir.
Okay. Is it a follow-up? Let's quickly take that because there are questions that also haven't been responded to. I think the issue of okay.
Very quick one, sir. On the turnaround, I have a case in point since 1995 until this fifth day of a teacher who has had his pension been quitted all these years. He only got, having started teaching in 1954, a payout of 11,000 rand.
We'll take on those cases after that. I think Mr. Chia would have to actually take your case with. I also have a number of cases which I just did not want to raise in the meeting. But we would actually appreciate, because as you indicated, Chairperson, that with some of these queries arising out of our constituencies, it's important that you actually assist. And you would find that it's only those fortunate ones that will have people pursuing their cases, like Mr. Johnson and myself. Some people do not have that kind of answers to people that will be able to pursue them. I'm sitting with one also since 2005, Mr. Johnson is older. minus in 2005, and I was just saying to my secretary, she must put together the dossier of information that keeps on coming back from the same office that says at some point we do not have the documentation. And at some point when you've collected all the documentation, you say, now I want to send the documentation. Somebody says, no, 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 but we have all those documents. All we want now is that whatever form. And when you send it, that whatever form, so, no, 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 but there are still other queries, but I mean, you know, it's in a written format, we'll be finishing with that. But I mean, some of the things that I would imagine would only be case studies, but they are just a microcosm of what is, you know, behind the administration. Let's respond to the other questions, because I would want us to quickly break for tea after these responses and then come back and round off, because Mr. Zulu is eagerly waiting for us also to dispense with the signing protocol. If you could just... No, I'm told that the price the committee charging for coming in. Let's respond to the other questions. The special pensions that is being now rounded up. The special pensions beneficiaries are not members of the GPA. They receive their monies from the fiscal, National Treasury. We administer that on their behalf. Even when they've been now completed, they will still receive the money through National Treasury by us. So that is the arrangement.
Just an agency
for National Treasury. But they will continue to receive their pension. The past discriminatory practices, there are two types. The one is on the non-judiciary forces. That is a special project on its own that has still not been completed. I was informed yesterday that a revised submission on the principles and policy of the NSF is going back to the Minister of Finance from the Department of Defense. On the other ones where women mostly in the homelands were regarded as permanent casual workers. That process is being dealt with by DPSA. But the funds have been set aside. They are in a special bank. Once that process is completed, their pensions will be adjusted. But the money also didn't come from the pension fund. It was funds from the fiscal.
There's also this, you know, the old homeland system had this R293 towns. They didn't have local authority. And there's also legacy issue there on pension that have not been resolved with. The CEO has been in discussion with EPLG, because they need to make good for that as well. It's not GEPF issues, and I'm not passing the buck here. These are legacy things from other Department of Defense, and until that dispensation has been cleared up at the policy level by the respective ministry, which is, you know, we kind of hamstrung in its implementation.
Have we addressed all the questions? Before we follow up, let's finish the questions first, because the question you might be following up is still to be responded to.
Okay. It's the same one that you were on.
Which one of it? On special pensions on the NSF?
Yes.
Okay.
Just to check whether the special pension does cover those people that are, you know, widely reported on, the ones that fought in the past wars, like World War One and so forth. Is there a way, because if you read through the media, they tell you that those people, the only others got the bicycles, and others are getting financed even to go and check the graves of their loved ones in, you know, other wards, yeah, in other countries, okay. Just to check if there's
yeah, okay.
A provision for them. Thank you.
Okay, but I would imagine when you speak special pensions, you speak in terms of the special pensions that the committee dealt with.
Yes.
Which doesn't cover that category. Okay. Yeah, because that's the one that has since then been incorporated into the GEPF, I would imagine. That's what you were talking about. Okay. Okay, proceed with the responses.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I just want to answer the issue on communications and stakeholder relations. I just want to elaborate that we have a member booklet which we use as a member education book so that members can understand how the benefits work and the processes within GPF. The second question is, the member booklet we also distribute to the employer group and when we do our roadshows. Now, the second tool that we use is we've got quarterly newsletters. Those newsletters are separated into active members which are based in the employer, as well as the other one for pensioners as separate because of they've got two different needs, and those we distribute quarterly. And we also do a special edition once in the year end just to thank our members. Now, we also have another tool, the benefit calculator, where our active members who are sitting in the employer have access to the internet and they can calculate their estimates of their benefits, which is on our internet. As well as we have the board are actually looking at the benefit statement where they are trying to say, can we send our members their benefits so that members can understand how much they have for their funds. That is the process that we are dealing with. Hopefully by next year we'll be able to send our members those statements.
What you're saying in a sense is at the moment you do not send out benefit statements. The only people that are able to access that information are people that would be able to do their calculations through the internet.
Yes, and through calling the call center, and that can be explained.
I think the chairperson indicated in the beginning that we are a defined benefit scheme. And a defined benefit scheme predetermines what members will get when they active. So historically, because that was a nonsense on how much they will get when they leave, it was not necessary to send out the benefits. But with now the member education process that we are following, we are saying when we go out there, we must just inform them that this is how the formula works, this is what you will get, but you will not get more or less. Get exactly this. If we were a defined contribution, then we would do otherwise. I think that's the main question. Now, the unclaimed benefit, yeah, in terms of law, Chairperson, is correct. After 3 years, we write it back into revenue, not to be forfeited. When members come back or we find them, we still pay the money. Just that they don't remain in the fund. It's a special revenue fund that the money is allocated to. But in terms of how we trace them, it is still a challenge because we have got only three regional offices, and we currently heavily depend on departments for information in terms of addresses and all those things. But we are working on this process that the CEO has alluded to. That in future we'll be able to on our own also to make our own findings. When we go into this process, we our plan is also for the current case get a tracing company to go and try to trace these people for us, because some of them are really in the far flung areas of the our rural area.
Some caffeine. 10 minutes. We are back here at exactly 1:30, and we'll proceed with round off.
Thank you. Get myself involved.
Can we settle down, please? The presenters to page 80 of their document, and then link that up with page 70. See, there's this loan that you have provided to this company, Black Ginger, for the acquisition of Telkom shares. Now, my question on this one, I think there are two or three linked together. I just want to find out why you acquire shares and then want to dispose them. You acquire them at a discount and still want to dispose of those shares at a discount. It doesn't make business sense to me. If I'm a trustee of a pension fund and I've got a company, Yellow Ginger, not Black Ginger, Yellow Ginger, Pty Limited, that acquire shares in Telkom, and I'm acquiring, I still want to establish on whose behalf were you acquiring the shares. Because if you are acquiring them, I've got Yellow Ginger, I am a member of the trustee of the Political Office Veterans Pension Fund. I acquire shares worth 3 billion rand or so for the benefit of members. If I want to dispose them of them, I wouldn't dispose them of at a discount, because I would want to dispose of them at a profit for the benefit of my members. I would want to establish the real story of the Black Ginger, not the Yellow Ginger, the Black Ginger. Why you acquire them at a discount, but why do you sell them off at a discount? And who are the beneficiaries? Are they members of the GEPF? If they're then members, why do you undersell them? The second one would be on your debtors, on investment debtors. You have got investment debtors of almost 6 billion rand. Can you explain to us? I know a large portion of it is Black Ginger. So the remaining one, can you tell us the story around that? And then, Chair, the last issue, I misplaced myself. The last issue, Chair, is on the voting within GEPF. I just want to understand the split. Whether it's 50% voting power by the employees and 50 by the employers. Or how is the arrangement around that? I think, Chair, if I find what I've misplaced, I'll come back to you. I've misplaced the question.
If there's still time.
Okay.
Of the next set of issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. On page 24, that's why I'm mentioning that you've got no capacity to carry out internal auditing. My question is, if you don't have capacity to get on internal auditing, aren't you exposed to fraud? How do you manage that? My same question also related to risk is on page 28. The question 28 under governance legislation. Perhaps in your reply, I might not have shared this, but that's why you're saying that the inability or to diligently identify and mitigate major business risk on governance basis has created challenges. So my question is, what are your major business risks in this case? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. One general question. Having recognized the fact that you are making good as the fund, my general question is that does it benefit the members, or what you are doing, the spin-off, are they benefiting the trustees or the fund itself? To me, it will be very imperative if it does benefit the member. The last one, Chairperson, is a recommendation. I heard the Chairperson saying that we are guilty as charged in terms of the legislation. I beg to say that I will plead not guilty. Because when I look at my responsibilities in terms of the Constitution, the department, which is Treasury, has to come up with pieces of legislation to me. If it does not, then it's not my fault. But it is my fault when there's a problem arose. I have to take to be accountable on that. And therefore, it means it gives me now a pleasure to say that I'm making a recommendation that we, as this portfolio committee, we quickly send a signal to the minister that and the treasurer that a speedy coming up with a piece of legislation that the fund should be governed under the PSLA. There was a lot of policy questions and other questions which have been raised here, or accounting in terms of the PSLA are problematic. So therefore, to cap that, we need a speedy piece of legislation, even if Chair, we will have to come back in January early, so that we can deal with that, because it's a lot of money which we're dealing with, and if it doesn't account in terms of the PSLA, then it's a serious problem. Thank you.
Okay, can we then take responses and members take responsibility of your constitutional obligations and not obligated to National Treasury? It's not only the National Treasury that can propose legislation. Parliament has all the powers to do that. And, if you say you plead not guilty individually, I agree, but collectively, you are very guilty. Okay. Let's take quick responses and then we'll bring this matter to a close and trust that the responses are not going to warrant any follow-ups, so that we can close this matter.
Chairperson, the easy one, the voting policy, I'm very proud to say that since 2005 up till now, we never reached a situation where we had to vote on a matter. We, right from the onset of our orientation, we move from the premise that our first responsibility is towards the fund. Any form of sectoral interest is secondary to our responsibility towards the fund. So all of us, whether we come from union environment, from employer environment, need to act in the best interest of the fund. And I can't recall any situation that I've presided over where we actually had to put the matter to the vote. But in terms of representation, 50% is from the employer and 50% is from the employee representatives as well as the pensioners. The black ginger, it's a very interesting animal. It's a legacy issue that we've inherited as the board. You remember the other, the elephant and those type of consortiums, where the the report given to us is that a certain gentleman acquired the rights to buy 15% of Telkom from a group called in Malaysia called Tikana. They own the shares, not Telkom, because Tikana shares. They didn't have the money by then to, because Tikana set a deadline that in 10 days or so you need to give us proof of funding. Their first port of call in South Africa was to go to the PIC. The PIC then said, you can't put us into a situation where we need to take such a quick decision. The PIC said, let's warehouse these shares for you until such time that you have got your whole consortium arrangements and due diligences in place. And the vehicle used to warehouse it was Black Ginger. But you will recall that there was an outcry even from the Minister of Finance by then that the empowerment credentials of that consortium was not too broad-based. And therefore, out of the 15%, only 6.6% or something like that went to that consortium. The PIC retained 5, and there is still this 3.3 floating out there, which has not been disposed of. Just for warehousing this black ginger, the shares in Black Ginger, the share price appreciated in that period until the finalization of the deal, substantially where we made 1.5 billion for just warehouses. Now,
It is still, there was an attempt by the PIC to sell a proposal to us as to how it best can, and he said, well, by then the proposal was not an acceptable one, and the 3.3 is still with us. And the view is to plug it into an earlier question relating to socially responsible investment. In using this, having already made quite a substantial amount of money out of it, that it might be a very good 3.3%, given all the things happening in telecom at the moment, to plug it into SRI effort. And we haven't worked out the details yet, but we will act in the best interest of the funds here. It's not a flea market on the Bumalotto. It's still fair value for the return on our assets here. But it is substantially appreciated, and I think through SRI process, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be dealt with, skills development, all those type of things, where our members can substantially benefit from society as a whole. There's a case to be made for that type of thing. But Mr. Green will fall into the details of black ginger, all these type of things. This is just my legacy report that I'm presenting to Parliament here. Mr. Green and them were part of the hardcore negotiations with Titani and all these people. Does the fund benefit the members or the trustees? This fund benefits the members and the members exclusively. That's why we even record the remuneration, the related parties, everything, every meeting, there's a disclosure form that we all need to fill in that board meeting. And I, up till now, not a single board member have been exposed for any, you know, related to any deals or whatever in our portfolio per se. And then I can look in the eyes today and say, nothing came to our attention yet along those lines. So what you see here fully applies to the benefit of the members. And that's where this whole notion of duty of care comes from, you know, to act in the best interest of the members. Your recommendation is well taken. I think January is a bit ambitious because I think there will... This thing will have to find its way within the public sector bargaining chambers. The current act, as well as it stands, is a construct of the public service bargaining outcome. You know, where benefits and all these things are negotiated. And to get civil servants into that bargaining chamber next year, January. Go ahead, make our day. This bill is up for review a long time, because it needs to be brought in line with some of the pension fund reform processes taking place in our country. But let's not do it piecemeal. Let's do it comprehensive. There should be a total overhaul of, not just look at the PFMA aspect of it. There might be other aspects that's not in sync with the current best practices in the industry, and we'll be well served to review those things and have a look at it, so that this fund, which is arguably the biggest in the country, can also be empowered from a legislative perspective to respond to some of your oversight requirements in Parliament.
The internal audit capacity, I think I've indicated that we don't have that capacity, but it has been outsourced. I think two types. We've got the fraud side, which has been outsourced to a company, PricewaterhouseCoopers. They are managing our fraud prevention strategy, and they are also doing the fraud investigation and forensic investigation under the supervision of the fraud and forensic manager. We were using, as I indicated earlier, a Deloitte. But the board has decided to get rid of Deloitte because they are also auditors of the fund. So there's conflict of interest. We are finalizing the appointment of a company called
PricewaterhouseCoopers. They are also auditors, but in terms of the fraud investigation, we didn't see any conflict of interest there, because they're not auditing anything. They are just making sure that any fraud activities or the intentions are stopped in the system. We've just finalized to replace the Deloitte, a company called Sigela, an empowerment company, to take over the internal audit responsibilities. We are in the process of appointing the risk manager and the internal audit permanently to supervise the company. Really, the major business risk in the view, I think members will know that there are a lot of cash change hands in the GPDF collections and the payout. So the main one is really on the cash, where people will do fraudulent transactions into their private banks. So they do that through the IT, the computer system. So that is our major business area, and of course corruption. Corruption in the sense that we've got the officials collecting. I think you've seen a case in KwaZulu-Natal with a lady who was a clerk in the Department of Health, who was inflating the number of years in service of people who were residing. That lady was arrested, and we also arrested two of our officials there. So those are the things that really are keeping us awake at night. Thank you.
Look, we have come to the debtors, yes,
sure. Thank you, through the chair. Thank you. Back in there. Thank you, through the Honourable Chair. The investment debtors include the provision made by the auditors, informed by the actuary, for all exit cases where these are infamously called the S cases. S cases are suspended cases, if you will. It's cases where we know that people are not contributing as part of this problem that we've already communicated on the backlog, but we're not receiving contributions for a member. And so we know we're not getting a contribution, but we have not yet received the duly completed documentation. But we do need to make provision for those payments in the books of accounts. And so aside from the black ginger, those are included in there together with unclaimed benefits in the investment data.
I just want you to go back to my earlier point. I just want to find out why are you not selling the shares at a premium. You are selling them, you acquire them at a discount, and you sell them at a discount. I just want to find out why not at a premium. Is it because of you want to, for black economic empowerment strategy, to achieve that objective? I would understand it if that's the case. But I just want to find out why are you not selling it at a premium.
Thank you. Thank you. I think, as the chairman pointed out, this was a deal that we inherited. So we inherited the contractual obligations of that deal. It was an empowerment deal at the time, and part of those contractual obligations was a discount to market on the exit. Where we have not yet found ourselves is on that exit strategy in terms of that which would be amicable to the or prudent from a board perspective. There have been proposals that have been put forward, and to date we're still exploring how best we can exit under those contractual conditions, but still meet with those conditions of prudence.
Follow up, Mr. Good.
Just a short one, Chair, that is the fund involved in bulking? If not, why not? Because according to the first P, if you don't bulk, on the other hand, you are actually disadvantaging your beneficiary.
unless you distribute bulk, then you take out the profit, then that's not illegal. But the bulking itself, they say it's not legal.
But the benefit here is predetermined. You don't have to bulk as long as you know you're going to meet your financial obligations. Mr. Johnson, your last follow-up?
Just on the internal audit. By its own terminology, internal, for me, you would suggest internal. Now, you are outsourcing. Now, also, if you could just answer very quickly, when you outsource in the light of all of those reorganizations that are taking place within the organization, how long will that external auditor would be engaged? Who shall have to deal with internal audit?
No, the difference between the external and the internal audit is that the external audit audits the after effects, after effects transaction, to express an opinion on whether there has been a fair management of the financial affairs and other things. The internal audit's purpose is to assist management to manage better in terms of process and procedure and internal controls. In this case, it is a heritage that we inherited when the body came in. We have this internal audit arrangement that has been outsourced because there were no skills. We had about four people who were internal but low level skills because those people were defined as excess. But what we have done now, effect from the 1st of November, the board has approved a fully fledged structure for internal audit that we are going to capacitate. That's why I'm saying we are going to appoint internal audit manager, risk manager, but in the process, the company that comes in will assist us to build that capacity. The contract is for 18 months. We expect that after 18 months, we will have created our own fully fledged internal audit.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this. As we have indicated, the issue of legislation we will take up. It's a very strong recommendation from the committee, which will have to be part of our report. And that should actually be prioritized. Public money also, and I would imagine also in the next question, one of the things that will have to be looked into is the Auditor General's involvement in your audit. Everybody that touches public funds, we want somebody who is above reproach, somebody who can do his job without fear or favor. Would you be in a position to appoint an auditor who gave you a qualified audit in future? I don't know. Because if a person gives you a qualified audit this year, maybe that guy is going to jeopardize his opportunities of being appointed as an auditor again next year. You come here and... those are the things that would really have to seriously look into. But we thank you for coming for us. It has been a fruitful engagement, and we trust that we will be able to improve from here and be able to. And we wish you well. Continue looking after the funds of the government employees. They are our major asset in the country. And as I had indicated, I said, Mr. Johnson, you have a special place. If you could also hand it over to Mr. Chia. Outside, yes. I'm also handing over my one to Mr. Chia, and I expect a quick response. This is how I'm going to measure the turnaround time. Okay. Exactly. Again, this morning. Not tomorrow morning. Okay. We are now going to call upon Mr. Zulu on SADC protocol to come and quickly give us responses on some of them, of the issues that have... Mr. Chair. There were issues that were raised, and we did indicate that you would be running a bit late, and we agreed that you would then not proceed until you have... All right. There were issues that were raised in the submission made by the Business Parliamentary Office and BUSA. We thought it would be proper to allow you an opportunity just to quickly respond to some of those before we formally consider the direct of the conference.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I would like to apologize basically on behalf of Treasury for arriving late for this meeting. Purely because of our other involvement in other areas, especially the G20 that is ended on Sunday. So, and that is not necessary. It's taking up our time in terms of looking at the submission that was sent to us by BUSA. However, at this point in time, I think what I'll do is, having looked at the document myself yesterday after arriving from Cape Town, and I was asked to return back this morning to make a presentation. So, in essence, Chairperson, what I can say is that the views or the perceptions that are expressed by BUSA have a great deal of convergence with what we submitted in the two presentations that we made to the committee on the Finance and Investment Protocol. And also, I would say it's a very optimistic or positive submission, which really captures in very succinctly what the Finance and Investment Protocol seeks to achieve. In that sense, Chairperson, what I'll do is that, as far as I understand, there's been no formal response by Treasury to the submission by BUSA. So in that sense, what I would like to do is to provide some preliminary comments on what BUSA has submitted. As I've indicated, Chairperson, I've gone through the document, I've looked at it. It seems as if there's a great deal of convergence, and there are a lot of truisms that we can agree to or we subscribe to. The idea, for example, that regional integration is a very involved and challenging process which requires a long-term view or strategy, it resonates very much with our approach of the regional integration within SADC. So in that sense, we feel that this is a very realistic approach that should be taken. There are no short-term or shortcuts to regional integration. It needs serious thinking. It needs a multifaceted strategy that, in this sense, as we begin with the ratification of the Finance and Investment Protocol, will involve business, will involve the legislator, and will involve a government in represented by the National Treasurer. Chairperson, also, I think the point that is made by BUSA with respect to the ratification of the protocol as representing a signaling effect by South Africa as a major region, that is also quite an important point to be made. If you remember, Chairperson, when we submitted the Finance and Investment Protocol to this committee, one of the issues that we raised was that South Africa has a big economy. It needs to take a leadership role within SADC. It needs to take a very strategic position as far as its participation is concerned. So that resonates very well with us. But also, Chairperson, I can also mention that this point is very important in the light of the fact that by next year, in 2008, South Africa would be taking over its share of SADC. So we need to send a very strong message that there's a strong commitment to regional integration, and we would like to we would like to be seen as a champion of free trade area, customs, you know, and the integration of the financial investment sector. So those are the key focus areas that Chairperson would like to push very strongly. The issues, there are other issues that Busa has raised regarding, I think it's on page 3, 2.1 on the firm level issues. We can't argue with that as your Chairperson, because policy cannot be done in isolation. So the juncture that exists should be closed as soon as far as possible between policy development and policy implementation. In this case, policy implementation would require that the market players be the ones who are able to read the signals that are coming from government, but also at the same time there's a mutual interplay between what business is doing and what government is doing. So if that disjuncture is not closed, there's going to be serious problems. Because in terms of the implementation of the financial investment protocol, it relies essentially on what business can do and how it can respond to the policy choices that we do. On foreign direct investment, it's another of the significant issues that we preoccupied with within the SADC region, Chairperson. And I can only indicate at this point in time that the best agents of investment promotion are not only government. Most of the investment promotion agencies that exist within SADC are government-owned or within the government fold, or to some extent they have an arm's length relationship with government. They are not necessarily private sector entities. So in this instance, if we need to push and change the perception of the world about the attraction for investment opportunities in Africa, the best agents for government to do that would be business itself. So a partnership with business is very critical. And I think Busa alludes to the recent developments that have taken place regarding the Chinese Industrial Commercial Bank. And also we can refer to other developments that took place, I think, last year when Barclays got into Absa. So those are pure private sector driven transactions. If government allows for an environment suitable for such kind of transactions, it is likely that there will be great successes achieved for regional integration. A lot of work still needs to be done, Chairperson, on investment. Our ranking in the world, according to the World Bank, are still not as attractive as we would like to be. But a lot of effort is being put towards making sure that investment is not only attractive, but it is based on sound macroeconomic principles. In particular, the provision of tax incentive, for example, should be done within a very sensitive fiscal policy framework. If you know, Chairperson, that at this point in time, whilst we're going towards trade reform, this needs to be countered by a good strategy that would contain not necessarily a proliferation of tax incentives, which basically erode the fiscal base of most of the country. Trade and investment promotion. Yes, I think there's a link basically, because in one of the studies that was done, there's a link between multilateralism and regionalism. So in a sense, what they advocate is there should be an open regional integration process that we adopt. What does that mean? It means what you're doing at the regional level should also allow the regional economy to take advantage of of global opportunities. So there should be, our approach has therefore been quite a systematic approach that leads to a fundamental policy integration and coordination, which means that pursuing a deeper regional integration agenda would need us to come up with policies such as regional industrial policies, competition policies, etc. That can be managed on a wider scale. So it's very important that we not only integrate at the level of activities or what we call a shallow regional integration, but we pursue a very deeper integration scheme at the policy level. So, Chairperson, I think on these issues, we don't differ much with what Busa has said. What basically they have introduced as a very unique contribution is that on page, I think, 62.4, which talks about the small, micro, and medium enterprises development. It's a point that is very valid in itself, because not only has the Finance and Investment Protocol stated it as a dedicated issue, it's there, you can pick it up in one of the areas under investment especially, but it's not entirely laid out in detail what exactly do we mean by it and how we would like to approach it. Perhaps, Chair, that is due to the fact that is because of the nature of the document itself, which is rather a broad principles based document that does not seek to position itself as an implementation plan. So an implementation plan would be developed later, but how exactly do we do that? So I think this issue basically would fit at that level. But what it seeks to do now that it has been flagged is that it puts the issue into the wider screen, so that we do not necessarily forget that African countries not only have a small or underdeveloped private sector, but also there's a lot of informal sector within those countries. So small business would naturally flourish in those circumstances, and also it would assist in funding the tax base of most of these countries if it's done successfully. So these are issues that are quite critical, and I think they need to be taken on board in the future. On development finance, basically, as we have conceptualized it within SADC currently, is focusing more on infrastructure development. It also has implications for credit markets or financial markets in terms of provision of credit to undertake these huge infrastructure projects. But at the practical level, what has happened so far is that there's an institutional arrangement that has been established within SADC. It's called the PPDF, Project Preparation and Development Facility. The aim basically of this is to provide the necessary support towards the making investment or infrastructure opportunities within SADC to be attractive to potential investors. But in the future, this would be extended to outright financing, that is providing financing to this project. But at the moment, it's just to prepare the project and then sell them to private investors. So, USA and the Apteco and a range of stakeholders that exist within Musa, and also some of the stakeholders that exist within the Parliamentary Business Office. I think this is an opportunity where they can play a very fundamental role in also responding to government signal that there are investment opportunities within the region and they need to be financed. Government within a prudent macroeconomic or fiscal practice cannot do everything. It, because of that position, it's limited in the amount of things that it can do. So this is where probably the role of business would be much more critical. So in conclusion, Chair, what I can say is that the ratification or approval of the document is not the end point. The way I see it, it's essentially the beginning of a much more involved process, including business, including Parliament, towards the implementation of this document. So those I would submit as the initial comments from National Treasurer. Should Busa be interested in probably a more detailed comment, we can do our best to provide them. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I actually would want to urge you to respond officially to COSAC. But also we take note of the fact that, as you have indicated, that the ratification does not preclude Busa's views from being incorporated as we move forward. And also in the participation of the project, the Preparation and Development Fund. Requirement in terms of Section 231 of the Constitution, I would want to implore this committee to adopt the protocol. Are there any objections to the protocol being adopted? I therefore read the report. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the Protocol on Finance and Investment of the Southern African Development Community, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Sub 2 of the Constitution, approve the said protocol. Agree to? Thank you. That then brings us to the end of this session, and we meet tomorrow at... We meet tomorrow at 9:30.
Okay.
We meet tomorrow at 9:30 at the same venue to consider the annual report of the FIOS Ombud, also to consider the annual report of the Portfolio Committee and the consideration of the committee's program for 2008. Okay. That will be our last meeting for the year. And, you know, we had made arrangements for a similar lunch. I know that has it arrived? Okay, when you hear those toilets. The members can help themselves, and we're all invited, and I know that there is another action meeting taking place at 12:30.
Mr. Chair, seeing that I've got other unfortunate business that I have to attend to tomorrow, I will not be able to attend the last committee meeting of the year. I just want to express my appreciation for, I think, a wonderful year of cooperation and very constructive way how we have dealt with all the issues, and it was a huge experience for me. And that obviously has encouraged me tremendously for the next year and years to come and to work with this committee. So thank you very much from my side.
Thanks, Mr. Marais, for the advance farewell speech. We thought we would do them tomorrow, but also on behalf of the committee, also to thank you for having joined the committee and having been very active, and your contributions are greatly valued. And we'll do the proper farewell speeches tomorrow when we close. No, can't speak on behalf of the GA. But thank you very much, and we wish you well. It's said that we won't be with you. But also, there is a letter that has been circulated from Unified Communications with regards to those of us that have these gadgets. there has been a bug, there is a problem, these gadgets have to go there to be reprogrammed. If you don't do that, you're going to lose all the information because there is a Trojan horse running inside your computer at the moment.
Yeah.
So make sure that we get that horse out. The thing has to go down to unified communications before tomorrow. No, but I'm sure you can send them. They said you can't send them today.
No, but they said, but here they say as soon as possible, before Wednesday.